So I'm Tim Evans. I'd like to welcome you and thank you for coming and listening to the panel today. We're going to have some good discussion. Rob Johnson and I are both at Adlumin. We came out from Arlington. And we've got some other guests here who I'll introduce here in just a second. Let's go ahead and start with Rob Johnson. Go ahead and introduce yourself and give us your background, please.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Robert Johnston. I'm the president and CEO of Adlumin. So I have a military background, spent 7.5 years in the Marine Corps, did all cyber throughout my career, a whole lot of incident response. So I've been very fortunate in some of the things and the opportunities, things I've been able to do, the opportunities that I've had, both inside the military and outside the military. Most notably, I ran the Russian breach of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So I led that investigation as well as the Democratic National Committee and numerous other investigations. I eventually founded my own company to detect and stop identity-based attacks. And so excited to be here and speak on the panel today. Thanks, Tim.
Great. Our next speaker is Dr. Ann Cox, who's the program manager for the cybersecurity division at DHS's S&T, Science and Technology. Ann, why don't you tell us what you do?
So I'm a little bit of a late bloomer. I didn't finish my PhD until I was 40 and went to work in the intelligence community for about 16 years and then transferred to DHS almost 6 years ago. In the cybersecurity division, we're a funding agency, and so we look at what gaps are, at what the requirements are, and then we put out a call for proposals. Sometimes they're aimed at small business, sometimes they are general, and then we get those proposals in, we evaluate them, and we fund the research.
All right, thank you. Our next speaker is Jennifer O'Daniel, and she is at the Center for Innovation and Technology in Virginia. And why don't you tell us what you do there? You're the investment director, correct?
I am. So CIT is a state-chartered nonprofit. So what that means is that we're Virginia's funding arm, and we advocate to the General Assembly and the governor on how research dollars are spent in the Commonwealth and what the Commonwealth is going to be good at technology-wise. I make the technology investments for CIT, so I invest in tech startups, mainly in cybersecurity, but also enterprise software.
Okay, thank you. And next we have Jason Chen, who's the managing director for Mach 37, which is a cyber accelerator in Virginia as well, and we are graduates of that accelerator. So it works, Jason. So please tell us what you do.
So as Tim mentioned, I'm the managing director of Mach 37. It's a accelerator program focused on seed stage cybersecurity startups. It's a traditional 90-day program. We've been around since about 2013. Since then, I've had over 50 cybersecurity startups graduate from our program. My role, I primarily oversee the day-to-day operations of the program and actually work with the CIT investment team to look at some of the startups that are applying to our program.
And actually make the investments for Mach 37.
Exactly, and make the investments. So, yep.
All right. Thank you. So as we go through questions today, we've certainly got some questions that we know they're going to be able to answer, right? But I'm hoping that you guys can come up with some questions that make it a little bit harder on them. I'm going to give them the softballs. You give them the hard balls. How's that sound? All right. Excellent. Just kidding, guys. I'm sure they won't do that. So let's start off our first question. So this is really about, we've seen so much happening in cybersecurity today with, you know, attacks on the DNC. Gosh, it's hard to keep straight the number of cyber attacks that we've seen recently. And there's a lot going on with Iran and other countries, China. Rob, you've been investigating for quite some time. How many years now?
Since 2008.
Okay. So since 2008, have you seen trends in the types of cyber attacks or the methodologies and TTPs, tactics, techniques, and procedures that the hackers are using to get in?
When I first got into cyber in 2008, it was a game for nation states, right? It was only nation states would play this cyber game at, kind of at the highest levels. It was the US, Russia, China, some big name nation states. As time has progressed, you know, when we look where we are today, if you would ask me in 2008, would we ever get to this point? I would have said, no way, it's impossible. It will always be a game of nation states. But it's morphed into so much more than that, right? Since Since that, the barriers to entry were really high. The knowledge you needed to enter cyber warfare was really high. In today's day and age, that's just not the case. You've seen the rise of cyber crime, of course, you know, crypto locker malware, extortion malware, as well as the lowering of those barriers of entries for any nation state, even the smallest little tiny nation states like Qatar or UAE or small, unsophisticated nation states, African countries, South American countries, they can easily enter the game of cyber warfare or play on that battlefield, and they can go toe-to-toe with the United States on any day they choose. And the reason they can is because it's all software built, right? There are no barriers to entry, such as heavy amounts of resources that you need to invest to build large pieces of hardware like carrier strike groups. Very few countries can build and bring those to bear on another country. But when it comes to a cyber campaign, even a country like North Korea or African countries or South American countries can be very effective at attacking a larger nation like the United States. And we have absolutely zero deterrence that stops them from doing that. There's no currently in place today, no deterrent methodology that would show even a smaller nation there are significant consequences other than potentially sanctions that would stop them from launching those attacks.
So I'd like to comment on that. I guess I've been in the business a little longer. I started in 96, 97.
And the first computer.
No, that was like 85.
My birth year.
But at that time we had what were called script kiddies, and you actually had to know like how to do command line and all that kind of thing. Now it's a GUI interface. You can go on the internet, on the dark web, you can buy these things, and anybody that has an interest in doing malicious things, it's a very low barrier to entry, like maybe a few $100s at most, and they can launch these attacks. They attack things like 911 centers. They'll overwhelm them with phone calls. And you would think, who would do this? And yet we see this on a regular basis.
Okay, excellent. And if you have a question in the audience, please just come up, stand behind me. I'll feel a little nervous, but I'll let you come up and ask your question, so please do that. I didn't give you that that
but
piece.
Sort of to answer those attacks, right? So we're seeing a lot more sort of consumer-facing, teaching people how not to like open phishing emails. We're seeing a lot of venture capital spin around that, and we're seeing a lot of venture capital spin around like the score of a company and then their partners, right, to see if they're sort of a cyber-friendly sort of company.
It's true. We've done a lot of research and development. One of the big problems that we have is people do not implement best practices. But even if all the best practices were implemented, we're still probably only about an 80 to 90% solution. There's still things that technically we really can't protect against.
All right. Anything else? All right. Let's move on to the next question here. This is for... Oh, yes, sir. It's not wireless.
So, for example...
Yeah, could you repeat the question?
Yes. The question was, what can we not yet protect against that is in that other 10 to 20%? For example, in 2015, we started a program to protect against distributed denial of service attacks. We had 8 different performers. About half of those have completed. The goal was to protect a 1,000 terabit per second attack against a medium-sized company. When that call for proposals went out, the program manager received a lot of static saying, we're never going to see 1,000 terabits per second. That's just not going to happen. Well, in October of 2016, the Mirai botnet attack, which took down Dyn, it affected things like Facebook and Twitter and so on. That exceeded the 1,000 terabit per second limit. Within the last 3 weeks, we've had 2 new records hit of, I think, 1.3 terabits and 1.7 terabits per second. Because of the way the malware is evolving, if they hit like 2 terabits per second or 3 terabits per second, which could happen, in the next few years, we really don't have a way to protect against that.
All right, good question. So this is for Dr. Cox. So Dr. Cox, how are startups and the government working together to help make strategy for how we better protect ourselves?
So I love the SBIR program. It's Small Business Innovative Research Funding. Every part of the federal government that has research dollars has a set aside for small businesses. What happens, at least at S&T, we have program managers that can develop a call for proposals, or you can actually go to the website and suggest a topic. And so those come out once a year in December every year. And we've had just great things happen. Here in Texas, I had one very small company. They doubled in size under their phase one. They went from one person to two. But they have developed great technology, and the topic was protecting against spoofing on telephones. And so those are going to a phase two now. And so another thing that we've looked at is protecting voice on 911 centers, because people do these TDoS attacks and so on. So if you're interested in that, I'm happy to talk to you about that. Or if you go to the S&T website and you look at the SBIR webpage, there are links there that can help you know what to do.
That's typically $100,000 for proof of concept phase one, and then about $750,000 for phase two.
It's usually 100, sometimes they're going to 150 now, and 6 months for phase one. Depending on which agency, 750 to a million for phase two in 2 years.
There's also a lot of public-private partnerships that you can see. Actually, Mach 37 was originally one. It was initially funded by the Commonwealth of Virginia, and after 3 years was four years was privatized. There are different levels of government that are helping to work with industry, work with academia to basically create these sort of hubs that can work on cybersecurity issues. Mach 37 is also not the only one that's done it, right? At the federal level in the UK, about a year or so ago, they stood up an accelerator program called Cylon. It's actually done some really impressive stuff. They've already had over 40 startups graduate from its program. And actually, just recently, the city of New York City released an RFP. They're creating a huge cyber center that is going to include not just a cybersecurity accelerator, but also a talent accelerator, a boot camp, to help generate a lot of, improve the talent flow that can go into not just startups, but also actually go into Fortune 500 companies and whatnot that are working on cybersecurity issues.
Yeah, that development of talent is really essential. One of our most difficult problems in cybersecurity is having a qualified workforce. And we don't have, they're short like 1 million or 2 million people over the next 5 years. It's the gap is huge. So
we currently have two open positions. It is hard to find. And the more specialized you get, the harder it is to find those individuals, for sure.
You've got someone behind you.
Excellent. All right.
Thank you all. Thank you for sharing your expertise with us and the specific examples that you provide, Dr. Cox. Robert, I have a question for you.
Closer to the mic, please.
I had a question for you, Robert. I saw your tag, some quote there. You saw the DNC. I hope you'll talk a little bit about it. But specifically, you mentioned deterrence. What are some concrete steps that the U.S. can do to deter these types of attacks occurring against us and our companies? Thanks.
If for deterrence, I'd like to draw the correlation to the other kind of realms of security mechanisms that we have as a country to deter. So in the nuclear world, you have mutually assured destruction. Really, that's high costs on both sides, right? So you know at any time that I could cause the same or worse level of damage, and that cost is so high that no country would ever want to bear it. In the conventional world, there's very few countries out there that can bring what the United States can bring to their shores. At any given time, we could park two carrier strike groups 50 miles off the coast of your country and run a blockade if we wanted to. There are very few countries in the world that are capable of doing that on an 18-hour notice, where the United States can. The problem with cyber is, at any given time, the United States can launch a cyber attack against your power grid or your electoral system, but at any time, there's nothing that stops that country from turning around and doing the same, if not worse, to the United States. So you have no parity. They sometimes call it parity in the national security world. There's no parity there. And so we've tried a few deterrence models now, right? Sanctions and diplomacy seem to be the most effective. The only time, you know, we've really seen it work was with China, when President Obama and China struck a deal that said no more economic espionage, or we'll immediately sanction those countries or those companies inside of China, so if they attempt to sell products back in the United States, they won't be allowed to do so. You know, economic espionage seemed to, you know, kind of go down in China, but that's not scalable across every country because China and the United States are economically tied. How do you deter a state like North Korea? North Korea and the United States are not economically tied. We can sanction them, but we've been doing that for like 40 years, right? We've been sanctioning North Korea. And so that deterrence model is not going to work there. I think at this point in time, you say you can't use cyber. You can't use offensive cyber as a deterrence model because you don't. There's no parity, right? So cyber is not what can be used as a deterrence. Sanctions and economic power, you have to use those other forms of power projection in order to use them as deterrents. And that would be economic warfare, political warfare, using those mechanisms to retaliate or attack other countries that may use cyber attacks against the United States.
This lack of parity has turned up some interesting things that have happened. For example, about 2010 or 11, Russia took Estonia off the grid for a while. What has resulted is that Estonia has developed a digital economy. They have put many resources into cybersecurity, and they are one of the best places for cybersecurity in the world right now. So Russia taking them off the grid actually spurred them, and they're this little bitty country, right? But it spurred them to develop what they needed to do to really protect themselves in the cyber realm.
And can you talk to what exactly they did?
I know that they have a digital ID for every citizen, and they, like everybody, uses two-factor authentication. It's a lot of what we know of as best practices they actually have implemented, and people actually do it.
So when I was at the National Security Agency, I was commander of a network warfare squadron for 6 years. Three of those years I spent engaging with Estonia on cybersecurity. I can tell you exactly what they did, but you know, basically they've gone through and they all have smart cards like DOD. They all have, you know, any citizen can go in, log in with their CAC card. They get onto the network for the government, and they can download any information the government has on them. They know exactly what the government has. It's very interesting.
I'm just curious if what the general education level about cybersecurity is in a country like Estonia compared to the United States, and if that's a factor in, I don't know what the right word is, their cybersecurity resilience or growth over the past several years.
Well, when they were taken off the grid, it was about the same as what we are here in the U.S., but because the government has focused their resources on building this digital identity and so on, I feel like they're far ahead of us at this point.
From both a technical standpoint or also even a talent standpoint, to go back to that?
I would say an implementation standpoint.
Okay.
I mean, one of our biggest problems is having, like, we know what, it's almost like being on a diet, right? Like you know what you need to do to lose weight, but you don't actually do it,
right?
Well, cybersecurity is kind of that way. We know much of what needs to happen, but people just don't do it. It's inconvenient, it's expensive,
right.
It takes time, but without that, then we continue to have these massive data breaches. People click on phishing emails. There's, you know, the list goes on and on.
Yeah.
I just wanted to follow up what you were saying, Mr. Johnson. You were saying that really the only methods of deterrence might be economic and political warfare. And I'm wondering if you've got any examples of that happening and it working.
So the example of it working are the threats of sanctions. And I would, when I said economic and political warfare, what I really meant was the alternative forms of warfare other than conventional or other than cyber or nuclear, right? So The example of it working are the threats of sanctions against China to deter economic espionage. We in no way deterred cyber warfare intelligence collection. Nations are going to collect intelligence against each other. That's what they do. That's part of their jobs. It should be a, you know, a regular day at the office, right? But political sanctions or economic sanctions were effective at deterring economic espionage. And so that's an example of it working. You know, an example of it not working at the same time is North Korea, right? We've been sanctioning sanction after sanction after sanction for North Korea. We have levied sanctions against Russia, and Russia has not stopped their offensive cyber campaign against the United States. So these are two examples where that has not been effective, one example where it has been effective. In the case with economic warfare between Russia and the United States, or economic warfare between North Korea and the United States, North Korea and the United States aren't tied economically, and Russia, lack of a better word, they have parity economically with the United States. They're a big boy on the block, right? You can't pick on a big boy on the block quite like that. You have to find another way because they're just not going to respond to economic sanctions. Specifically, they have a lot of power over us as well economically because they control, you know, if you remember when Russia shut off the flow of natural gas into Ukraine, right, it had incredible ripple effects into Europe, which affected the U.S. economy, right? So they have an incredible amount of power that they can wield affecting the United States economy as well as we can with sanctions. So there you have to find something else to deter a country like Russia, and economic sanctions has proven thus far not to be effective.
Thank you all for being here. A couple questions. One is the NSA has been collecting information against its mandate at certain levels. The recent data breaches at Equifax or Experian, can't remember which one. There's a variety of things that large institutions in our own culture aren't doing to protect our data. A couple recommendations on what each of us could take away from here to protect ourselves against these malicious foreign agents and these incompetent or potentially eventually malicious domestic agents as individuals. So kind of the personal responsibility side of things, and what should we be doing?
Are you calling the NSA a domestic agent?
Is it?
It is not. It is not. There are rules and regulations. I come from that world. It is definitely not. I promise you everyone over there is working in the best interest of the average American's security. But what can you do? The average American doesn't necessarily need to be worried about you being a Russian target unless you work in government or someone who you think they may be interested in. Now, things like election meddling, you may have been affected by someone trying to sway your opinion, and that's kind of a different story, but the average American should take all those normal steps that everyone knows about, like be educated on phishing, use antivirus, don't click on links, because what you need to be worried about, I think, should be most on your radar is not you know, Russian agents or domestic agents, as you would want to call them. You need to be worried about criminals because they're after your bank account, right? That's going to be what affects the day-to-day American more than espionage. The average American won't be affected by espionage. A lot of you feel like you are now because of an election meddling, right? And that did affect, you know, the ground floor America, the grassroots American, and you know, every state in the union. But that is kind of a unique case. You're the biggest threat, I still believe, to the average citizen is cybercrime, where they're trying to steal your money.
I would add to that, keep everything patched and up to date.
Real quick, how many of you have antivirus software on your mobile devices?
And understand, antivirus will get rid of a lot of stuff, but it is not a complete protection.
But it's a start, so real quick, how many? Yeah. I was trying to...
No, you need it.
It's a pretty small percentage of folks on average are trying to, you know, take those steps as effective as they might be, better than nothing. It's still something.
Goes back to the best practice discussion. Antivirus, keep your patches up to date. Don't click on things you don't know about. Maybe even, I know some ISPs will offer a service that gives you a little more protection. Yeah. Consider doing that depending on your economic situation.
cybersecurity is a really unique market too, in that, and having, you know, I wasn't always a vendor, right? I was an operations guy in security for a long time, and now that I've been a vendor and selling in cybersecurity, you know, it comes down to resources. Security solutions have gotten so expensive that small and medium-sized businesses that can easily be affected by that, they can't buy the best-in-breed solutions. Or even if a company is doing $1 billion in revenue a year, if their expenses are $990 million, you know, they really don't have that much of a budget, right? If their cost of goods sold. So the economics of cybersecurity are pricing out, you know, Fortune 2000 and below. That's what I feel like we've seen. And we do a lot of work in credit union, regional bank, financial services, right? These guys aren't Bank of America with $1 trillion in assets under management. Some of them have $2.5 billion, $3.5, $4.5 billion in assets under management, which sounds like a lot, but it's not, because their job is making loans, their cost of goods sold is really high, they're nonprofits, so they're not, you know, churning huge executive bonuses at the end of the year. Their budget for cybersecurity is quite small. And when it comes to making a decision between buying a new cybersecurity tool at $500,000 or hiring 5 new tellers to support their customer, the decision is easy. It's 5 new tellers to support their customer, right? Not the $500,000 security tool. And so security has grown so much and the solutions have gotten so expensive that even if you're a bank with $3.5 billion in assets under management, frankly, you can't afford a good portion of what's out there. And that's what's making it really, really tough, is they've priced us, the security vendors have priced ourselves out of what is a huge portion of the market.
Which is why you're seeing all the threat score companies, because I'm not worried that Bank of America is getting hacked. I'm worried that one of their vendors is, thus me being a customer of Bank of America and breach too.
Yeah, I mean, threat score, like security scorecard type stuff. I mean, that's good. You come in and you tell me my score's an 80%. Got it. You know, I still, at the end of the day, have to have my next-gen firewall. I have to have endpoint detection. I have to have the technical utilities in place in order to do the same things that Bank of America is capable of employing, and they're just not able to purchase the same solutions,
right?
Because they don't have the budget.
There's an effort by either or maybe both Consumer Reports and Underwriters Laboratory, and I know Mudge Zatko has also started an effort to do software evaluation so that you'll know when you purchase something whether it's actually effective. Sometimes your most expensive solutions are not as effective as a less expensive solution. So those would be things to watch in the for consumers in particular.
You touched on this a little bit, but what are the biggest challenges right now in identifying actors, utilizing social media to sway voters or influence the American people, and then how can industry help you?
Do you want me to start?
Yes.
Okay, so attribution is an enormous problem in cybersecurity. Usually you can tell where something came from, maybe one hop out, but spoofing or saying you're coming from an address that you're not actually coming from is rampant on the internet. People use it all the time. There is what's called BCP 38 or BCP 84, which are a couple of standards that came out 10 to 20 years ago. But the problem is the economics don't work, because if you implement that, you can break your own system if you don't do it right, and it doesn't help you at all. It just helps everybody else. And so we actually have funded an effort to get people to do that. There's now a website that you can go to and test your own system and see if you are allowing spoof traffic. And so if we could get rid of spoof traffic on the internet, that would be huge.
You talked earlier about the government having issues with implementing some of the maybe new technologies, such as the ID. What's causing some of the implementation issues or resistance?
I'm sorry, I didn't get the question.
Oh, sorry. You were talking earlier about specifically with the Estonia's ID system, talking about the government having resistance or having difficulty implementing these systems. What's causing this implementation resistance?
I think he's talking about that it's hard to sell into the government for startups,
right, so,
and how it's getting in.
So Estonia is way ahead with this ID card and things. What is our resistance here in the U.S. to doing that? What's the government's resistance to doing that?
Well, if you try to, they've put out even a standard driver's license requirements, and there's half a dozen states that have not done this, and it was like 10 years ago. So having a universal ID, I mean, here in the United States, we're very independent. I mean, think about everybody that went to California for the gold rush, right? So that's kind of our way of thinking about things. We're out there, we're by ourselves, we don't want the government to regulate us, and people just aren't gonna do it.
There's actually some interesting research out there that talks about in the future where a lot of the emerging technologies and solutions for cybersecurity are gonna come from. Right now, people tend to think it's gonna come from, you know, first world countries like the US and whatnot, but they actually argue, and again, this is exploratory research, so take it for what it is, but they actually argue that over the next 5, 10, 15 years, as countries that aren't currently as digitally enabled as we are start to become more digitally enabled, you basically are going to have a huge population growth as far as people who aren't currently connected are going to become connected, and there's going to be a whole new set of problems and challenges and topics that they want addressed in cybersecurity that aren't currently being it. And the likelihood, therefore, that small businesses, startups, the governments from those countries are going to work to address those issues is very high, right? So basically the argument is that you may actually see a lot of new innovative technology coming out of the developing countries versus the developed countries, and what that actually may play or how it may actually play out in the market would be very, very interesting. Worth looking up. There's, I think, a report out there, like a Forrester Maverick report on it, talks about it.
Hi, so we've spoken about several specific attacks, right? So fake news being one, social attack, about, you know, whole systems going down, this digital attack. Some of the work I do is with the Army Cyber Institute, and we've been talking about blended attacks. So I'd love to hear what you guys think about blended attacks on systems, on people, maybe including kinetic, that we can start, you know, solving for or preventing now.
So when you say blended attacks, you mean like a mix between the kinetic and non-kinetic effects, like election meddling, right?
Right.
Offensive cyber mixed with marketing on Facebook.
Right.
Yeah. That's certainly not a new concept. They've been writing about that. Just the methods have changed, right?
Right.
Clauschwitz has written books on blended attacks of using cavalry and infantry, and that was his version of that. In today's version, you're seeing how can you achieve a very specific objective using all the tools that you have available. And so I think one of the newest tools of warfare that was brought out recently within the past year and a half is the use of public opinion and the use of the average citizen to achieve an effect, right? And then their tool to do that was the tools that have the ability to distribute content to millions upon millions of Americans across state lines. And so that is not something that I think we thought of or the people in the intelligence agency or the government thought could be used in that way. Now they do use it to collect intelligence, right? And they've been using social networking to collect intelligence on individuals for a very, very long time, because there's a lot of tools that you can bring out of that, but no one ever thought to use it as a mechanism of warfare. So we got to catch up to that one. And I read, you know, the big social networking websites, Facebook and Twitter and things like that are hiring a bunch of people for exactly that. And it's a mixture of technological capabilities that will have to be employed there, but also they're putting in process capabilities. For political ads, there's additional vetting now. And, you know, there's never one solution fits all. You're going to have to put a lot of things into place, both processes, people, and technology, to achieve a better layer of security across, you know, what kind of content is allowed to reach U.S. citizens, balancing, frankly, people's right to view content and privacy as well.
Can I have a follow-up? So as we integrate Internet of Things into our homes, that's smart devices that can be hacked, right? How will that change the battlefield?
Oh, it makes us so vulnerable. I've heard it called the Internet of Threats.
I like that.
Yeah, obviously, the more devices you put on the internet, the more devices can be leveraged and used to attack. And the Mirai botnet was a good example of using Internet of Things technology to create a massive amount of traffic to cause some damaging effects. But frankly, the way society is going, we're getting closer ties to technology. It's only going to get worse. It's not going to get any better. People love their devices. You know, they really do, and they will keep buying them. And the more devices you put on the internet, the more vulnerability points you put in there. Absolutely.
Thanks.
Just don't put your bank account in your refrigerator. You'll be okay.
It's probably going that way, though.
Hi, I wanted to ask specifically about the voting systems in particular. I know that the DHS has said that 21 states were potentially targeted in the last election. And I was kind of curious, you know, we had talked about Estonia, and I know that they are really in the forefront of like digital voting. I know Norway has also, you know, experimented with online voting systems. And here in the U.S., I know that there are some people who are pushing for, you know, sort of upgrading everything. I mean, a lot of our voting machines are still running on like outdated Windows. But I was just wondering, you know, what are your thoughts on, and specifically, I guess, maybe some of the things that the DHS is doing to either modernize voting and sort of push it more into the digital sphere, or, you know, sort of rely on paper ballots, which has come up as recently as this week as well. So I'm kind of curious, you know, what the trend is. Are we going to go more, be more connected and have, you know, everything on the internet, the intranet or whatever, or is it going to go back to like paper until we can figure this out? Yeah, thanks.
So I'm on the research side of the house. And the people handling the voting issues are on the operational side of the house. So I don't know exactly what's going on. I can tell you that for paper ballots, I believe what the system is that it's electronic voting, and then if there's a challenge, they have the paper ballots to go back to. And personally, my personal opinion is that's a good idea.
So Estonia does about 40% of their voting online, 40% of their population. So the 95-year-old elderly woman can get online and vote, and they do. It's really surprising. It's actually pretty amazing.
And I think Brazil has more like 80% or 90% online voting.
Brazil is electronic voting. And actually, my question is very similar to the last one. In Estonia, voters vote online, you know, since 2005. And in the last elections, 36% of the population voted online. And what is, you know, amazing for me is that people older than 50 years old was the majority of voters, online voters. So I was going to ask you, what would you prefer, to vote on paper or to vote using technology? What do you think is going to be the trend? You already said that. But what do you think a voting system need to be secure? Do you think it's about audits, about cybersecurity? And also I would like to know, or you to explain a little more, about the Russian hacking in the US elections, because what I understood, it was that a mail server was hacked, not a single voting machine was hacked, although voting machines here in the US are very old. That's my question.
So one of the problems we do have is voter turnout in the United States, right? Like getting people actually to the ballot box. And the reason for that is the same reason why all these other apps are successful, is they're making things more convenient to, you know, get a car or whatever you want. Online voting is going to do that. You're going to have a better, if you provide the ballot box and you provide the ability to online vote, you're going to get a better voter turnout.
Yeah.
You know, that's the positives, and that's what you want, is to make voting easier so that more citizens get involved and vote. Because we, I think as a country, voter turnout at the ballot box is pretty low, mm-hmm. right? So that'll help that. And I think we'll get there. I would like to see that. You just have to keep it secure, and you have to build it with security and mindset from the very beginning. And you're gonna have to protect it, heavily protect it. It's going to be expensive, and it's going to cost a lot of money. and you're going to have to invest a lot into the protection of that. So that's what, you know, I would like to see personally is online voting so that we can get the voter turnout that I think we all would like to see in our election system.
Yeah, some countries, they actually fine you if you don't vote. I think Australia's that way. But I don't think we'll ever see that in the U.S.
I'm with Alberta Innovates in Canada, and we're a funder. And I was really intrigued by your comments about SBIR, which, by the way, we emulated and made an Alberta SBIR initiative, so thank you for that. But the combination of SBIR with cybersecurity accelerators, and I'm wondering if you can just expand on that and the role of government, what governments can, the role we can play.
So I've worked directly with Science and Technology Director at the SBIR office. We don't do accelerators, but the other panelists have a lot more experience with that.
So I think sort of the importance of accelerator, and so National Science Foundation, which has an SBIR program, also has an accelerator called iCore that they do ahead of time and sort of take people through the lean startup model as they think about building their companies and then applying for SBIR. But I think the accelerators are important because it's sort of about putting the mentor network around you and learning from your peers and sort of how someone who's sort of been there, done that, is a little bit further than you, can sort of help you sort of walk that path the correct way.
So I guess what I'm getting at is an integrated system where if we can put our resources together so that we had the accelerator and we're looking for, we call them purple squirrels that are going to make it, pull them through and get them into SBIR so that we're creating an integrated system that actually moves the needle. Has that been thought or is it two separate agencies?
We actually send people through the NSF accelerator, but we do not run one ourselves.
Okay, thank you.
Is a purple squirrel a unicorn? Is that the same thing?
They're potential unicorns. We call them narwhals in Canada.
Nice.
And I should mention, because I see them in the audience, we've got DHS has an Emerge Accelerator where they accelerate first responders through.
I'm going back to the voting machines. Real fast, because there are analog solutions that could make the machines more secure, the old, outdated software vulnerable machines, including that over 80% of them have wireless capability, even though policy says you can't update through wireless, you can't transmit through wireless, they're still vulnerable because the components are there. Can you give any insight on how some analog solution that would literally cost very little money gets any kind of traction when security has become a high dollar business?
Security is the only way an analog solution would get any kind of traction. And that would be one heck of an argument, right? Because it comes down, I would imagine, and just the business side of me coming out, like cost of goods sold, I've now got to build this voting machine with antique parts. Actually, the newer parts are getting pretty cheap. Like, I don't know why.
Just remove the component. Take the wireless capability out. It's mind-boggling to me that this gets no traction, that people don't take it seriously, even though policy says they can't use it. The hackers have shown that you could get in previously with a BlackBerry because the component exists within the machine. People who are spending millions of dollars on security and trying to look for solutions aren't even considering this. How do we get that kind of solution on the table? Because it's not going to make anybody any money.
Well, economics drive a lot of things.
They do. That's why I'm asking.
I don't have a good answer for you. I'm sorry.
I'm so sorry, too. Thank you.
Good question.
Great question.
You mentioned something earlier that was really interesting. We have police and firefighters that are taxpayer funded to protect us from physical threats. Is there some sort of right to security that could make security not just something for the Fortune 2000? And then if you could give like a ranking to how the intelligence community has done over the past like 3 years, is it an A to like an F? If each of you could kind of let us know what your thoughts are on how we're doing right now. Kind of both of those questions, if I could hear your opinions on that, that'd be great.
This is non-attribution, just to, you know, Chatham House rules. Please don't.
Could you repeat the first question?
Yeah.
police? It was two-part. You gave us a two-part.
Yeah, like we have police and firefighters that protect us from physical threats. Could there be something like that online that helps small businesses, individuals, large businesses alike, rather than having this cost fall on individuals, it be a government mandate like police and firefighters?
So we have a project in the state of Washington called Pisces Northwest that is looking at small municipalities. They're trying to do a subscription model so that people will pay somewhere between $100 and $1,000 a month for a city. And then they have a central SOC where all the logs are sent. They have real cyber analysts there who can do the analysis. They're working with community colleges and universities to train students to actually go out and do the remediation. One thing that is near and dear to my heart is what I call help the little guy. I have not yet been able to get funding to do a very big program, but I really like this model that we're trying out in Washington State, and I'm hopeful that it will be successful. But it has to be something that's self-sustaining.
There are a lot of cybersecurity startups that are going after the small, medium businesses. Like, that's their new client base for all the threat intel stuff. I think the problem with most of these solutions is a lot of them sort of stop at a certain revenue amount and aren't going to get any more funding, and because they really don't work. So you're seeing a lot of things that are venture capital funded just flat out don't work, that are being implemented or not. So I think there's no really great solution yet for that market.
All right, this is an open-ended question for any of you or all of you to answer. But what are you most fascinated about, what you're seeing today, what you're looking at, what you're working on? That might blow our minds, or, you know, there are a lot of professionals, a lot of practitioners in here. We've asked a lot of questions about things that are known. But what about the unknowns, and what are the fascinating things that are out there that you can tell us about? Thank you.
One of the things we're working on as a company, and it's why I left and started it, was the rise of identity-based attacks. Security solutions are actually getting pretty good at detection and pretty good at response. And what we've seen everyone do, from, you know, a 13-year-old kid that's breaking into systems in his basement to the Russian FSB and SVR, is they've turned to the path of least resistance. When they attack your network, they're attacking it with their username and password or some kind of authentication mechanism or some kind of credential. And that's an incredibly, incredibly hard problem to solve. And what exacerbates that is the fact that you're moving to a hybrid cloud environment. So you have local systems that your network or business may operate on, as well as Amazon Web Services or Azure Cloud or Office 365 email. You've got this hybrid ecosystem that's running your business operations. And any one of those points is a point of vulnerability. And so how are you going to stop the human-based attack or identity-based attack? And that's, you know, one of the exciting things that we see on a daily basis, and one of the exciting things that our team and company aim to solve here today and moving into the future.
So I love working in this area because I'm dealing with academia, with small business, with large business, with national labs. We're developing cutting-edge technology that will really make a difference if we can get people to actually use it. I mentioned the Pisces Northwest. I love that model. I hope that that is successful. Time will tell. We've got DDoS, distributed denial of service, mitigation and communication technology we've developed that is starting to go commercial that may be able to help mitigate some of these larger attacks. It's just a fascinating area to see what's out there.
All right, so Jennifer, I'm going to ask you a question that I think you'll be able to answer for sure. So what trends in investing in cybersecurity are you seeing from the venture capital out there?
Sure, so you know, we're still seeing a ton of money spent on things that are probably sort of solved, which is identifying threats. We're seeing a lot of money being spent on companies taking actions on those threats. We're seeing a lot on sort of education around not hitting on the phishing emails to sort of do like corporate training around that. And, you know, I said this before, but we see a ton of the sort of scoring, right? So you've got Home Depot is more probably pretty secure, but all those vendors going down, down to like the IoT on like their air conditioning system, right? You could use that to hack in. So you're starting to see people trying to solve around those issues.
Great. So Jason, I'm going to ask you a question that I think you'll be able to answer since it's your question. So how is artificial intelligence and machine learning changing the industry approaches to cybersecurity?
Good question. And afterwards, I'll answer this, and if anyone else wants to chime in a second, that's great, but I want to go back to the previous question about what fascinates me. So there's both good and bad sides to the AI and machine learning work that's going on in cybersecurity. I think most people tend to think about the good stuff, which is pretty straightforward, right? AI and machine learning are allowing organizations, companies to basically automate very complex processes. They're able to basically normalize or better understand normal behavior for privileged accounts and whatnot. And as a result, by creating a baseline of behavior, they're able to better understand the risk environment around them, right? So that's probably something that most people in here already know. I think the side of this that most people don't think about is how the bad guys are also able to use that. They're using basically the exact same things right against us, and that, I think, goes to what Anne was saying earlier about, you know, the denial of service attacks and how they're getting much more stronger and stronger and stronger. And it's because the reality is that as AI and machine learning improve, and we get better at them on the defensive side of things, the bad guys are getting better at them as well, and that's what scares me the most. As real quick, just going back to the where the gentleman is about what fascinates me. You know, at Mach 37, we see a lot of companies that apply to our program. You know, Jen just mentions a few of the trends, and there's really no shortage of really interesting ideas that companies are working on from a technological standpoint. But believe it or not, what I find most interesting right now is actually going back to that talent gap and how we have a huge shortage of talent to fill cybersecurity jobs over the next few years. There's been some reports out there that say we're gonna have a million and a half shortage by 2020. And so I just wanted to take a moment to talk about how on the heels of International Women's Day yesterday, there's some really interesting statistics out there about diversity, gender diversity specifically in cybersecurity. And I think that's something that really needs to be thought of more and addressed. Basically, today it's approximately 10 to 11% of the cybersecurity workforce is female. What bothers me is that you actually can rewind and go back to 2013 and it's been consistent since then. But if you think about what's been going on over the past 5 or so years and how much education and talk there has been about women in technology, women in cybersecurity, STEM and whatnot, and supposedly all the things that we're trying to do to get women more involved in technology and cybersecurity, if the statistic has basically remained constant over the last 5 years, it basically means that what we've been doing hasn't been working. And that's something that really concerns me. And when you think about the sophistication of the attacks and how they're getting worse or better and better and better for the bad guys, we need to start thinking about new and different ways to defeat them, to combat them. And it's all well and good that we're investing in thinking about these technological things, but from a creativity and innovation standpoint, if you have a homogenous group of people who are basically working on those things, I think you're inherently handcuffing yourself, right? So that's a long roundabout way that the thing that I think about the most is really how there needs to be a lot more focus and talk and emphasis on really figuring out how to get women in cybersecurity. You look historically about how, you know, World War II, how women helped, you know, help the war front, right? Basically, every time you've brought women into the equation to help solve a problem, we've ended up doing better, we've ended up winning. Name of this panel, War Games, right? If we're at war, if you think we're at war, which I think everyone would agree that we are, if we're basically not bringing in women into this to help fight it, I would argue that's pretty much game over.
I think it takes us back again to sort of the peer groups, though. I mean, if you look at successful startups, they tend to surround themselves with, again, the people who've done it before. Yeah. You see a lot of peer group dinners that sort of get together. And so I think you often miss that with women because there really isn't that sort of generation before. Right. I'm putting together a dinner at RSA, and you know, I've pulled the list from PitchBook of all the women founders in a cybersecurity startup, and all the female VCs that back cybersecurity companies. Well, there's 10 of those, and maybe like 90 of the other, and there's just, it's a small pool of people. So there aren't like that group of people you can sort of get together. But sort of speaking of that, March 29th in DC, we're doing something called Uniting Women in Cybersecurity. Sort of bringing together those sort of peer groups to start discussing these topics. Pretty cool event to go to.
Hi, so one of the things you talked about, I believe it was Robert, it was about the lack of voter turnout. And so right now I'm working with a startup company that's trying to kind of combat the lack of voter turnout on local elections. And a lot of the reasons people say that they're not voting locally is because they can't get information. And they're also saying that their trust in the media with the information that's available is at an all-time low. And so as a startup, what we're trying to do is we're trying to combat this by offering people a newsfeed that kind of gives them information, but it also gives a bias indicator. So it shows when there is an article out about like environmental changes or something like that, if there's an underlying bias in it that can give you a percentage. And we're trying to use machine learning and AI to do that. Do you guys have any initial thoughts on that or feedback, if you think that's possible?
Yeah, so I don't vote in a whole lot of local elections. You know, I live in D.C. too, so apparently, you know, we don't have exactly 100% representation all over. But, you know, lack of education, absolutely. I still think the fundamental consumer problem is always convenience. Mm-hmm. You know, why is online shopping an absolute killer? It's because I don't have to get in my car and drive to Walmart to go get my stuff. I just get it delivered to my doorstep, right? So education will take you a direction. I think it's only going to take you so far, because now you're giving them more stuff to do, more stuff to read. In a way, you're making the information more accessible, but making it more inconvenient for the consumer at the same time, because now I have to read your pamphlet. Like, how many pamphlets do I get in the mail, you know, a week? It's a lot, right? And so how many you know, things do I have to read in a week? It's still a lot. So, you know, getting more information, I think, on how local elections would better affect me and why I should go vote in a local election. I think it's one of my things about local elections. It's like, well, I get it. President of the United States is gonna affect me. That's why I should go vote for that. When in reality, you know, who ends up president may not exactly be the individual that will affect me most. Local elections might directly affect me more, because they can affect my local taxes or what I pay county tax, or, you know, all of those things. So, you know, educating consumers probably on why they should vote for local elections and keeping them updated. But we've got to make, to get better voter turnout, you've got to make it more convenient. Like, voting is the most inconvenient thing that we still do in the most archaic way. I have to show up in the morning, there's massive lines, right? Huge amounts of people. You know, it's a deterrent, frankly. Why would I want to go do that? Like, I'd rather stay at home and watch TV. It is inconvenient, and consumers, they really want convenience.
And I just don't think on a local level people really think it concerns them that much. So you have to kind of throw out that data point that compels me to, like, this is why it matters to me, which is probably different than matters to Jason or to Ann, and sort of be able to figure out how to target me with something specific. Because I don't think the information sort of is enough. Because if I actually cared about the election, I would probably go out and do my own research, right? So you got to figure out a reason for me to want to go and do the research.
Thank you.
Okay, I think that is actually a wrap. I think we're right at 12 o'clock, and I don't want everybody to feel like you need to hang on, but if you have a question, you're welcome to come up. If you've asked a question today, please stop back and see me behind the stage there. I got some little swag for you. It's actually useful. So, and if you didn't ask a question, just line up behind them. So, thanks. Thank you to all of our panelists. Great information today. Thank you.